Welcome back. It's hour two of the Roger Hedgecock Show. In for Roger, Phil Kirpin from Americans for Prosperity. We're going to get to more of your calls in a bit, but we've got a terrific guest right now, probably the world expert on stopping all this global warming and renewable energy craziness from Competitive Enterprise Institute and American Tradition Institute, and best-selling author of three wonderful books. Very pleased to have Chris Horner with us on the show. Chris, how are you?
Terrific.
Well, Chris, the left never sleeps on this stuff. I saw the latest is that a lot of this green job stuff is now going to be part of the new infrastructure bank. What is that about? Can you educate us?
It's not a pyramid scheme. It's a trapezoid, apparently. We've got a lot of new data on this green jobs showing it is exactly what we predicted it would be, what it has been in the countries the president used to refer us to look to as his models, but no longer gives that speech. And so we also know, and we've actually had confirmed this evening, it's not going to be called green jobs, it's going to be called, or stimulus, it will be called targeted infrastructure investment, because the people apparently won't get it. So what it is the 80-plus billion, this is according to Politico speaking to the White House, the 80-plus billion in wealth transferred from the productive sector to create politically preferred positions, temporary jobs, 224,000 such temporary jobs. Therefore, at a cost of $355,555 per temporary green job in the stimulus was not enough. It is like your friend Paul Krugman would say, it just wasn't big enough. So they're going to add some more.
Truly. Chris, and we're talking to Chris Horner from the Competitive Enterprise Institute. This is Phil Kirpin in for Roger Hedgecock. Are these more windmills and solar panels or more cash for caulkers? What are these infrastructure bank jobs actually going to be, or do we know?
Well, based on experience, we have there's a loan guarantee program at the Department of Energy, which has been the subject of two Government Accountability Office reports just ripping it to shreds as utterly unaccountable, apparently wasteful, non-transparent, but a boondoggle. I think they're going to continue along those lines, just adding to that program. Therefore, it would be more promotion of windmills and solar panels, as opposed to the caulking and other things, but I'm sure that will remain a part of it, but it's just the latter has been subject to so many local investigative reports about the tremendous waste. And we just heard this week about 14 jobs, mostly administrative, to obviously do nothing, created in Seattle at a cost of $20 million. You don't make that up in volume. but what they're going to do is seek to claim, they're calling it clean energy. And today, I mean, we know this is the case. They're telegraphing it. Today in Las Vegas, Harry Reid and the vice president, so the Senate Majority Leader and the vice president, are investing a lot of time and political capital in Las Vegas to kick this off at a clean energy conference, Reid's fourth in a row, saying that it's just a couple of years away. It's always been just a couple of years away. It will always be actually a few decades away. It has been since wind-powered electricity first came online back in 1891.
Now, here's the question, though, Chris. Can we count on Republicans in the House to block this, or we really have to get people engaged and calling in there, make sure they stay firm? What's going to happen in the House on this proposal?
It's a very good question because here's the issue. The argument is, well, this will never get through the Senate. It's not really to create jobs. It's a campaign move. It's a political move. And it's going to start in the Senate. I agree with all of that. But the plan is to make Republicans, quote, vote against jobs. Now, again, these are so far $355,000 per temporary job positions, which is vastly more expensive even than the average, quote, stimulus job. But then it moves to that. If they succeed in pressuring the Senate Republicans, then I do fear for the House Republicans because, and frankly, even if the Senate Republicans roll over or somehow this gets through, and, you know, the Senate obviously operates differently than a House majority, Republican majority, you're going to face a lot of pressure for why won't they move. Harry Reid's argument in National Journal today in a piece that I have to comment on this, the New York Times gave the herd, the media, gave the herd the signal last week that it was okay to criticize these things, calling it a pipe dream. And so National Journal, Sacramento Bee, and at least three other outlets today started criticizing this renewed push for green jobs. What if that gets some traction? Because people say you're voting against jobs. That's what Reid telegraphed today in his quote to National Journal. And you just never know with so many people hurting, looking for anything, and someone promising them guaranteed employment. The political dynamics are, I'm concerned as you are.
Well, that's a very frightening possibility, and I hope folks who are concerned about this will weigh in with their members of Congress, even if they are Republicans, and make sure they stand up to the latest incarnation of this green job stuff. Sort of at the same time, though, I know there's another effort moving forward to actually create a new set of subsidies for the natural gas industry that's got a bunch of Republicans on board. Do you think that one's going anywhere?
See, that's what gives people like you and me, who are sentenced to observing this sausage making for a living and seeing politicians disappoint you time and time again, that's what's got us worried about House Republicans. We had erstwhile self-proclaimed Tea Party Republicans, conservatives, supporting this move to, through state intervention, move the transport sector onto natural gas because a few billionaires who have contributed to Republican causes have a lot of interest in natural gas and said, the price is too low. I need to get my payoff. So it's called the T. Boone doggle. T. Boone Pickens has been out there because he's irrepressible, which is a nice way of saying he likes to get out there in the media and hear himself talk. But that's been actually very clever as well, because his partner in this is a guy named George Soros, the financier of left-wing causes, aggressively left-wing causes, who has bought up stakes in uneconomic interests, waiting for a payoff from Republicans to create a new ethanol, to create, I think, the fifth ethanol. We have ethanol, we have windmills, we have solar panels, we've got another one, and now we've got this coming. Well, windmills have already surpassed ethanol at, I think it's $6 billion per year, $9 billion per year, $6 billion for corn ethanol, and so on for solar panels. This will be even more expensive, I believe. So it's in the works. If it passes a Republican House, it will be passed immediately in the Senate. Conservative Republicans are, forgive me for this beltway speak we fall into, but they're saying, don't worry, it won't get through conference. That was from the majority leader's office, who used to say, don't worry, it'll never get a vote. Well, it's a little confused right now whether it is going to get a vote. The argument is T. Boone is telling people that John Boehner promised him a vote. But anyway, if they don't need to go to conference, the health care takeover didn't go to conference. The Senate can just pass the House bill. And we have a fourth or fifth ethanol.
Well,
probably at the time we could least afford it in our history.
You would have to think that even if they don't understand free market economics, Republican congressmen should be smart enough not to want to enrich George Soros further. And I would hope that folks could appeal to them and say no on H.R. 1380, which is the bill number on this one, on that basis alone, if no other. We're talking with Chris Horner from the Competitive Enterprise Institute, best-selling author of several books. The most recent one, Power Grab, is excellent. Buy it if you've not yet bought it. This is Phil Kirby. In for Roger Hedgecock on the Roger Hedgecock Show. Chris, I saw that your old friend James Hansen was actually arrested for protesting the Keystone XL pipeline. Can't we get rid of this guy? What is he still doing at NASA?
Okay, James Hansen is an astronomer who is regularly cited in the media as a climatologist, something I laid out in pleadings. We filed NASA, a suit against NASA in federal court in Washington about 8 weeks ago, seeking his ethics records because of serial extracurricular activities, that some of which are very questionable, many of them very lucrative. And NASA, by the way, denied that he's widely called a climatologist. He was called that by the Washington Post and New York Times in the past week. He does a lot of these things, I think, trying to be martyred. He desperately was trying to get fired and be martyred in the Bush administration. But something happened, and after giving a 2006 interview to 60 Minutes, where he started waving around, he became very, very strident in his activism. You know, he's fond of Nazi analogies. Anybody who disagrees with him is a Nazi. Cole is a Nazi somehow, and so on. He suddenly began taking in about $250,000 from outside sources, often expressly for his work for the taxpayer, which is not permissible. In the last 4 years, more than doubling his taxpayer salary. So I think NASA has let him run rogue. Yes, he keeps getting arrested in front of the White House. I think he's trying to be martyred, but now NASA's withholding his ethics records because we want to see. He has these stunts, sure, but he's also now been exposed in the public record as making more than $1 million in the last 4 years from outside sources, much of it highly, highly questionable given federal ethics rules. you can't privately benefit from public office. So these stunts aren't really the issue, but they are indicative of the sort of, I think there's a bent on this guy's part. He desperately wants to be fired and martyred, but he didn't expect to be martyred by the Obama administration.
Yeah, it would be pretty interesting, I think, for them to be the ones who finally rid us of this guy. We're talking with Chris Horner. This is Phil Kirpin in for Roger Hedgecock. Chris, you've also been in the news again recently for the Michael Mann effort in Virginia to find out what his records are. Can you update us on that one?
Yeah, UVA, University of Virginia, where Mann was an associate research professor for a few years back when he produced what was called the Smoking Gun, for catastrophic man-made global warming theory, rewriting 1,000 years of history, showing that suddenly the variable climate that we knew about with the medieval warm period and the Little Ice Age, well, it actually, that was wrong. The history was not as these people lived it after all. It was what his computer model said, but it was stable until the climate was stable until the horrors of industrial man, and that was called the hockey stick. Thoroughly debunked, thoroughly exposed, but not fully investigated. ClimateGate happened a couple of years ago, which was a leak, obviously, by an internal disgruntled whistleblower who was tired of FOIA in the UK being frustrated because they were being dishonestly avoiding the law there. And a lot of emails about the hockey stick as well as the UK's temperature record came out showing it to be what we thought it was. In fact, what I described it was a year earlier in a book called Red Hot Lies. So they were affirmations to many of us. Well, all of this talk now about inquiries and investigations and even exonerations of Dr. Mann have been proven once again to be false when UVA repeated them while refusing to turn over 4,000 pages, at least five times as many ClimateGate emails from UVA as were released in ClimateGate, showing that, in fact, they don't want us to see. Whenever the global warming industry says there's nothing to see here, move along, or else you're a very bad person who thinks the moon landing was faked, it's a sign that you probably ought to keep looking. And UVA's recent document release, where they withheld 4,000 pages of hockey stick-related emails, shows they don't want us to see this. And Mann commented to Science Magazine, showing it to us that he and the university were working collaboratively on what they did and did not release to the public. So we're taking it to a judge, and we expect that the taxpayer will ultimately get what the taxpayer paid for, which is these records.
You know, we keep finding out that there's no there behind all of these efforts on green jobs and global warming and the rest. What do you think the left is really after? What do you think the motivation is on this stuff?
Unless they're all lying, all these people I quote in Power Grab and that you've pointed out in many columns, it's what they say it's about. You know, their mentor, at least Mr. Obama's mentor and others, Saul Alinsky, said the issue isn't the issue. The issue is an excuse. It's a vehicle. The laundry list of demands in response to the climate issue is the same as their laundry list of demands for every greatest threat facing mankind that's rolled down the Autobahn for decades. And that is transferring decisions from individuals to the state. Because if you can't be trusted with these freedoms, what to do with abundant, reliable electricity and so on, because you might use them. So the chief economist for the UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, Otto Edenhofer, recently helpfully volunteered something more clearly than most of them have, but echoing many of them. He said, you have to disavow, one has to free oneself of the illusion that international climate policy is about the environment. Yes, he said this. He said, it is instead about how we de facto redistribute the world's wealth. He said this. I want to know why I should think he's lying to me. Van Jones said pretty much the same thing. The spokesman for the Blue-Green Alliance of Labor Unions and Green Pressure Groups said essentially the same thing.
It's amazing.
They all keep saying
it's amazing.
The issue's not the issue.
Well, thank you very much, Chris Horner, one of the real experts on this. Do check out all of his work. All of his writings are phenomenal on these issues. We'll be back after this break with your calls. Phil Kirpin in for Roger Hedgecock, 877-84-ROGER, 877-847-6437. Listening to the Roger Hedgecock Show. This is Phil Kirpin in for Roger, and we've been talking about federal regulation, what it means for us, what the costs are, whether our economy can handle all these rules and regulations. We're going to take calls again in a second, but if you're pro-regulation, if you love the regulators, I don't want to shut you out of the conversation. Call in and challenge me on this stuff. 877-84-ROGER, 877-847-6437. We've got our next caller from San Diego, Jeff. What do you have to say about the EPA, Jeff?
Oh, I love the EPA. I think we should have a pristine country with everybody living off the land and everybody sitting in caves and in the cold and the dark. Then we'll have a perfect environment. Yeah, that would be just great according to them. Okay, I'm being a little sarcastic, but my real feeling is that the EPA is destroying businesses because it's overstepping their bounds. Look back in 2009. The government picked the Delta smelt over jobs in California. They killed how many tens of thousands of jobs because they refused to give water to the farmers. It's just the pendulum has swung way too far on the regulatory scale, and the EPA is killing jobs. Let's talk about California. Let's talk about these formaldehyde regulations. They're going to impose the most stringent formaldehyde regulations in the world. Why? I mean,
it seems every time we have an industry doing well, someone on the left wants to kill it, and chemicals are back booming in this country in part because we've got cheap natural gas, and they don't want us to be able to drill for it. They want to ban fracking, and they don't want us to be able to make chemicals anymore. So, you know, I don't know what they want us to do, Jeff.
The whole hydrofracking thing, it's just a panic. You know, there's no science behind the scare about that. The wells, the natural gas wells, are down at 5,000, 8,000 feet. They're nowhere near any aquifers. The only possible way that any of those chemicals can get into the aquifer is if they, you know, the well breaks up way up near the surface. It's just anybody who wants to ban hydrofracking.
You're completely correct, Jeff. And on the I'm trying to get to another caller, so I'm gonna end here with you. But look. The Endangered Species Act is another huge, huge problem, and they're trying to shut down the West Texas oil fields over the Dunes sagebrush lizard, which is another newly discovered lizard that used to just be an ordinary lizard. Now we're being told it's endangered. They're trying to shut that down, too. So, Jeff, thanks for those concerns. Totally agree about the Endangered Species Act. Let's go very quickly. Dean from Michigan. Dean, what's on your mind?
Hey, how are you doing tonight?
I'm doing great. How are you?
Not too bad. I just got some, you know, a few issues. I listen to everything that I hear about the EPA, and I've dealt with them before. I'm in the environmental cleanup business, and it just befuddles me when, you know, we're told that you know, spilling a cup of gas when we fill our tank is like the same amount of carbon emissions that would come out of our
tailpipe. Dean, it's not even just that. They were trying to shut down milk spills. But, Dean, I'll have to get back to that after this break. You're listening to The Roger Hedgecock Show. Phil Kirpin filling in, 877-84-ROGER, 877-847-6437.
Roger Hedgecock.
Radio has never sounded so red, white, and blue.
At work, I have it on.
You guys are the best.
This is Radio America.
You're listening to The Roger Hedgecock Show. Phil Kirpin sitting in for Roger today. Let's go back to the phone. I've got Dean from Michigan. Sorry about cutting you off there, Dean. What did you want to say about the EPA?
Basically, EPA, environmental, you know, federal agency. In Michigan here, we got the DEQ, Department of Environmental Quality, which is obviously regulated by the EPA. We get permits all the time for a gasoline spill site. A gasoline station has a leak, and we go in and clean it up. But they allow us to pump out of the ground vapors, gasoline vapors, into the air at 2,700 pounds per month. That equates to, you know, roughly about 300 gallons of gasoline to basically evaporate into the air. And I just have to say that for all your listeners out there, you know, in my business, cleaning up the environment is I just see this. They're so heavy on being an industry, but yet they turn around once industry has an issue or a problem, they don't have any issue with letting us just, you know, clean up the groundwater and the ground so it doesn't get into the groundwater, which is good. But we can turn around and spew that much hydrocarbons into the air. And
well, you know, Dean, I don't know a lot about this specific issue you're talking about, but I think what you're getting at that's critically important is that when these agencies are spending all their time on these ideological political agendas and trying to regulate the heck out of industry, they don't do their basic mission, which is to make sure we've got clean air and clean water and do the very simple basics because they're too busy with all this other crazy ideological stuff. And that's a real shame. Do I understand you right there?
I agree that it's very politicalized. And that's pretty much, I just wanted your listeners to know that, you know, that's, you know, they bang hard on one side, but then they'll turn around and say, oh, well, you've had a problem. Let's let you do this to clean it up. Which is granted, it's taking it out of the water, but it's spewing it into the air. So,
well, I think that's a very good point, Dean. Thanks for calling in and sharing that with us. I want to get to my next guest. We've got you know, a good friend of mine, someone who's been fighting all kinds of regulations on all kinds of fronts, not just in the auto industry, but in the technology industry as well, which is what I really want to talk to him about. We've got Seton Motley from Less Government. Seton, you with us?
I am, Phil. How are you, sir?
I'm doing terrific, Seton. Can you, first of all, what is Less Government and what's your mission?
The mission of Less Government is to reduce the size, scope, and sphere of influence of government. And that pertains to any one of the numerous areas you've talked about at AFP. You've talked about in your upcoming book, EPA, NLRB, you name it, energy, commerce, interior. It's just government is a black hole. Money, light, and energy go in and nothing comes out. So we want to reduce the number of things government does to its constitutional limits, and we'll see a flourishing country once again.
And I know, Seton Motley, I know that you've been watchdogging government motors, and we were just talking to a caller from Michigan. What's the latest with our state-owned auto company?
Government Motors. Government Motors is, I wrote a piece on Monday for Big Government, which is an oxymoron with my organization's name. But anyway, called Building on Failure. And you're familiar with the expression building on success. They're building on failure. What they're doing is they are making about 1,330 Chevy Volts a month. This is a car that costs them $41,000 to make, and they sell it for $41,000, which means it is completely unprofitable. It is also twice as much as any other car in that class, because if you're going to buy a car that size, it's going to be roughly $20,000, so no one's going to buy it. As exhibited by, it peaked at its peak sales month was January, just after it debuted, with 321 vehicles. In July, it was 125. So what is General Motors' response to this fabulous success? They're going to up the production of Chevy Volts to 5,000 a month from 1,300 a month. So they're building on failure. So
It seems to me, Seton, and correct me if I'm wrong, it seems to me they're waiting for this 54.5 mile per gallon mandate to take effect from the EPA, so any car worth driving will become illegal and will be forced to buy the Volt.
Well, the thing is, Chevy Volt's not there either. The Chevy Volt doesn't meet that mandate either. So even if they go to that mandate, and even if it gets through, which, of course, we're going to fight tooth and nail to prevent, even if they get there, the Chevy Volt isn't the vehicle to do that. So that doesn't even, you know, it doesn't even solve that problem. It doesn't even create a marketplace for that problem. CEO Jan Akerson, who was appointed by Obama and is from the car law group, he's not a car guy, he's the one who said he wanted a dollar a gallon increase in the gas tax, and that would certainly be with, at least in part, in mind to force people out of the bigger cars they want to drive into cars like the Chevy Volt. But the Chevy Volt does not get 54 plus miles per gallon, even with the battery going.
I mean, that's pretty amazing. Electric. You think about it. They're going to put a mandate on us that not even the greenest car on the market can meet. That's pretty frightening if you think about it. We're talking with Seton Motley of of less government. This is Phil Kirpin subbing in for Roger Hedgecock. We'll be back to your calls in the next segment. If you want to get on the line, 877-84-ROGER, 877-847-6437. Seton, I know you also do a lot of work in the technology area, and you know, I want to talk to you about this because we have this terrible, terrible economy right now, and there's really only one bright spot. It's the tech sector, where unemployment's 3.3%. How long before government gets their hands on that, and what are they doing to mess up the one thing that's working for us right now?
You know, I was saying for months, you know, they're fixing to assault the one area of the economy that's working. I didn't have tangible numbers. Then, of course, you and I both saw that story that came out where unemployment's been entrenched at 9+% and the tech sector's at 3.3. So what are they doing? We're a couple months away from the FCC, the Federal Communication Commission, December 21st net neutrality order is finally going to be filed with the Federal Register. It got passed on a 3-2 Democrat Party line vote back in December, but it doesn't go into effect until it's filed with the Federal Register. Well, they've been stalling for months. I kind of view it as a dog that gets a hold of a car bumper, and it's holding the wheels up in the air, and they're spinning, and as soon as he lets go of the car, or the bumper, he's going to get run over, because you've got, of course, the Congressional Review Act in the House working to undo it.
I mean, let's get to that in a second. First, okay. Slow down a little bit. What is net neutrality for anyone who might not know?
Net neutrality is socialism for the internet. It guarantees everybody equal amounts of nothing. Basically, what it says is it's like telling the fire department, okay, that house is on fire, the house next door is brushing his teeth, but you get equal amounts of water for both houses. Net neutrality basically says, tells the internet companies that have spent hundreds of billions of dollars building the internet infrastructure that they can't manage it to optimize it for everyone. They have to treat all traffic equally. Now, that's destructive from a free market perspective that quickly begets a free speech problem. From a free market perspective, just to give you the latest example, Netflix, which is a huge company that is built upon using the internet to deliver their products to their customers, net neutrality would say no matter how much bandwidth net neutrality uses, they can't charge them more. So people like a grandma who all she does on the internet is email her children, her grandchildren, has to pay more for her internet to subsidize Netflix using hundreds of billions of kilobytes of bandwidth a second to download all these movies to people's houses. It really is an assault on the industry to affect an ideological outcome. The ultimate objective is to drive all private ownership out of the internet to be replaced by government.
Well, it seems to me that if everyone's got to pay the same price, the people who don't use a lot of internet, the people who just use email and web surfing and so on, they're going to see their bills go up a lot if this rule actually takes effect.
If you're trying to offset Netflix with the grandma, then grandma's bill is going to go up exponentially, yes.
Well, to me, it just seems crazy to start to regulate the one area that's been working great, which is the internet. And it's been working great because it hasn't had all these government regulations. Now, you mentioned the Congressional Review Act as one way that we might try to stop this. How would that work, and what is the Congressional Review Act, Seton?
The Congressional Review Act is designed by the Congress to rein in rogue agencies. The FCC here certainly qualifies. There's a 60-day shot clock on the Congressional Review Act. Once the bill is filed, once the order is filed with the Federal Register, as we discussed, it has not yet done that. The House went ahead and passed their version of the Congressional Review Act. It now awaits Senate action. Here's the good news about the Senate action. Once they file the order with the Register, the Senate can pick it up. It cannot be filibustered, which means it does not require 60 votes. It requires but 51. All 47 Republicans have said, we will vote for that, which means we have to call four Democrat votes. 23 Senate Democrats are up for re-election next year, many from swing or even Republican states. So I think, and I think you would agree, we can maybe shake that four out of the Senate, and then it becomes a really interesting visual aid, because then it lands on Obama's desk, and he's been making all these, you know, noises about allegedly deregulating. He's written Wall Street Journal op-eds, he's issued executive orders. Well, then we would have a prime example of prime opportunity for him to actually put his pen where his mouth has been, and it would be very interesting going into 2012 to see what he would do with a Congressional Review Act bill on his desk to undo the illegal net neutrality order coming out of the FCC.
Yeah, and this is Phil Kirpin in for Roger Hedgecock. We're talking to Seton Motley from Less Government. You mentioned that this order is illegal. I actually agree with that. There was a decision in Comcast versus FCC, just a very recent district court decision here in D.C., where they said the FCC has no power to do anything like this, and it'll be interesting to see what the courts do. I know that Ken Cuccinelli, the Attorney General of Virginia, has promised to file, and I think we'll see some other complaints against this order as well. But Seton Motley, I've been talking about this with everyone here tonight. What can we do to get jobs in this country? I know you're not going to say more government spending like Obama wants, but what's your prescription for the economy?
I just wrote a piece. It hasn't been published yet, so this will be a little sneak preview. It is entitled, More Jobs? Less Government. Thankfully, I think we just saw from the House Republicans the memo from House Majority Leader Eric Cantor, where they're going to go after a large swath of regulation and say, get rid of this. It's killing jobs. I want to see less government spending and less government regulation, because it's an inverse ratio. The bigger government gets, the smaller the private sector gets. Remember, did you ever play that game Red Light, Green Light when you were a kid, Phil?
I played it.
Yep. If the government's at green light, the private sector's at red light, because they just stop and freeze in amber and say, okay, where's the next government regulatory anvil going to fall? You know, where am I going to get hit? Is my business going to get hit? Am I going to invest in something that all of a sudden, you know, we spent $100 million investing in this, and then all of a sudden it's made illegal or it's regulated to the point where we can't make our money back? So if the government is active, the private sector stops and waits for the government to stop moving. This government has not stopped moving since Obama was sworn in. So what I want to see is less government action, and then start to peel back all of the action, all the advancement of government that we've seen over the last 100 years, and we'll start to see the private sector begin to expand to fill that void. That's one of the things the left doesn't understand. They only think from the prism of government creates jobs. They don't grasp the concept that if the government recedes, the private sector will be more than willing to fill in. They certainly get the point that they complain that all the private sectors come, all these private sector companies are sitting on capital, but they're not investing. They're not investing because they're afraid of the government. Once the government starts to recede, believe me, if it becomes attractive again for these companies to invest in the private sector, they most certainly will. It will expand the private sector. It will create jobs. It will create tax revenue, which these idiots can then spend.
Well, I agree with you. I don't know that I like that last part, but I agree with you. This is Phil Kirpin in for Roger Hedgecock. We're talking with Seton Motley of Less Government. He says the way we get jobs, the way we get more jobs is to have less government. I think that's exactly right. That's exactly what we need. And I'll tell you, Seton, the part of the Republican jobs agenda that I'm most excited about is the RAINS Act, H.R. 10, which they're going to vote on later this year. And that would actually flip around this whole idea of Congress having to overrule regulations. And instead, it would say regulations can't take effect until after Congress approves them, sort of the constitutional process.
It's a great idea, and it's a great bill, precisely because these entities, these agencies, these commissions, are for the most part created by Congress,
and they should be held accountable to them. Thank you so much, Seton Motley, for joining us here on the Roger Hedgecock Show. Phil Kirpin sitting in for Roger. Join the conversation, 877-84-ROGER, 877-847-6437. You're listening to the Roger Hedgecock Show. Phil Kirpin sitting in for Roger. Let's go right to the phones. We've got Ron from San Diego. Ron, go right ahead.
Yeah, hi. So you don't believe in government and federal government overextending itself. So when the oil spill happened, the federal government should not even have been there to monitor or regulate how they drill for oil. Is that correct?
Well, I think inept regulation in the Minerals Management Service was one of the reasons that BP was able to get away with having practices that were far below the standard industry practices that all the other major integrateds were following. And look, it was a government failure, no question about it.
Right. Oh, exactly. And you know what? I think the federal government shouldn't help with natural disasters either, should they?
Well, you know, that actually, Ron, I'm glad you raised that, because this is sort of a big controversy right now. Should we have a huge federal
controversy? It's not a big controversy.
Well, actually, it is a big controversy right now, whether, and if I could finish my comment here, it's a big controversy whether we need to have offsetting spending cuts to pay for any disaster relief from the federal level. Republicans saying we've got no money, we're bankrupt as a country. If we need to pay for this, then we ought to do it in a way that cuts other spending. But I would suggest, actually, that we should rely on private charity in these situations. There's a great story called Not Yours to Give. I would encourage folks to Google it. Davy Crockett. He gave a famous speech on the House floor where he pointed out that it's not charitable to spend money that you've coercively taken from people in the form of taxation. And I think that we would be a much better country if we relied on charity for charitable goods and not trying to use tax power. As much as we might want to help people, it tends to backfire and leave people worse off. Now, clearly, if there's some legitimate exigency where there's a legitimate national purpose, you might have a need for some government spending. But even then, I'm with Eric Cantor. There ought to be spending cuts in order to pay for it. Let's go back to the phone. We've got Jeff from San Diego. Jeff?
Hi, Phil. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, Jeff. How are you?
Pretty good. Well, Phil, I've been on your show several years ago. You had another recent caller in about the formaldehyde issue in this area in California, and I was one of the lead people in trying to get a resolve from the California Resource Board on it. I'm a former federal EPA inspector in my past, and worked very diligently here in the past 3 or 4 years on trying to set this government straight. Also helped Assembly Dan Logue line up the meeting or trek from California, the 11 assemblymen, and Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom to meet with Rick Perry in Austin, Texas back in April 14th. And out of those meetings and hearings, what we came up with why companies are leaving this state are, number one, uncertainty in regulatory practices and taxation practices. So they are leaving this state and actually leaving the country to get away from this overzealous government that's putting everybody out of business, I guess other than the tech industry, but also the heavy industrial areas in this country and the state are being shipped out of this country or at least out of the state.
Jeff, I agree with you. You know, I think if you look at what's working in California and in the U.S. in general, it's where we don't have heavy regulation. That's why the tech sector has succeeded, and that's why we're suffering so much in manufacturing and in industrial production. And, you know, there's a balancing act, and we're way past the point of balance right now. We've got environmental standards that make it impossible to do business in this country in far too many areas. And so I think you've got that exactly right, Jeff. Thanks so much for calling in on that. And, you know, while we're at it, you know, we're going to have a guest in the next segment after the break who's going to talk to us about California trying to link up with the northeastern states on their cap and trade program. Because, folks, if you think it's bad now in California, just wait until cap and trade takes effect. You're going to have an expensive cap and tax program driving up the cost of everything in that state. So we'll get to that after the break with Steve Lonergan and more of your calls. You're listening to Phil Kirpin in for Roger Hedgecock on The Roger Hedgecock Show. What do you think about these issues? How can we get jobs back? 877-84-ROGER, 877-847-6437.
Roger Hedgecock.